on the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Gregory Stockel, and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
There is a long tradition in the African nation of Ghana of local artists painting movie posters to advertise films. But as interest in local movie theaters continues to drop, Daniel Enum Jasper has found success selling his posters in other countries. Jasper recently spoke with reporters from Reuters from his studio workspace in Accra. He presented one of his current works, showing actor Paul Newman holding a pair of guns in a poster for the 1969 movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. He also showed unfinished paintings that included actors John Travolta and Bruce Lee. Jasper was one of the country's first movie poster designers and has been doing the job for 30 years. From the late 1970s through the 1990s, Ghana developed a tradition of advertising films with colorful and descriptive hand-painted posters. During that period, local movie theaters were extremely popular throughout the country. Artists competed over who could bring in the most people with their imaginative and often violent designs. But over the years, the market for Jasper's work has greatly changed. With the rise of the Internet, Ghana's independent theaters began to disappear. People are no longer interested in going out to watch a movie when it can be watched from the comfort of their phones, Jasper said. But there is a growing interest in owning these hand-painted posters internationally, he added. Now they hang them in private rooms or show them in exhibitions. One market where Jasper's work has gained appeal is the United States, where the posters are valued as unusual representations of a specific period in African art. Westerns and action movies were traditionally popular, as were Bollywood and Chinese films. Many of the posters included supernatural elements and extreme violence, even if the films had none. And physical details of the actors were often exaggerated. Joseph Orduro Frimpong is a pop culture expert and professor at Ghana's Ashesi University. He has been collecting movie posters for years and owns several of Jasper's paintings. He plans to show his posters at the Center for African Popular Culture when it opens at the university later this year. He said he hopes people will realize the historical importance of the posters. Of course, there is an aesthetic value to the posters, how crazy it is and all of that, Oduro Frimpong said. But we use them to have a conversation with students. We tell them not to think about what they're seeing now, but to think of these art forms as symbols of history that can tell their own stories. I'm Brian Lynn. Catherine Russell is the newly appointed chief of the United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF. She said on February 25th that the Taliban government in Afghanistan is showing a commitment to permitting girls to go to school across the country. The international community has demanded the Taliban continue educating women. Russell was appointed earlier in February. She said it remains to be seen if the Taliban's commitment to reopening schools for girls and women on March 21st will change conditions or restrictions. Russell told the Associated Press that Taliban officials have given UNICEF signs that they will open schools for girls and women. She said that we are hopeful that is going to happen, and we believe it should happen. Even though there is no legal ban, girls around the age of 12 have effectively been barred from going to school in most of the country since the Taliban took control 6 months ago. The Taliban government has blamed delays on lack of good spaces, especially in cities, to support schools that must have a separate area for girls. Schools in about 10 provinces have continued without stopping since the Taliban takeover. Private universities and schools in the capital, Kabul, have remained open. Universities for women have also restarted in several provinces. The Taliban government has promised all universities will reopen for women in the coming weeks. Apart from statements saying that schools will reopen for all girls, little else has been made public about other possible restrictions or changes in education. Russell said she met with Taliban officials this week to discuss concerns from child health to rights to education. The United Nations and international organizations face growing difficulties with Afghanistan's increasing humanitarian crisis. The UN projects this year that over 1 million children will need treatment for malnutrition, and that 97% of Afghans could be living below the line of poverty. A UNICEF $2 billion request from donors for aid is only 17% financed. Kabul's Indira Gandhi Hospital for Children is filled with mothers from across the country seeking treatment for their malnourished babies. Zermina Mohammed said she did not have the $10 needed to pay for medication. She asked a family member in Kabul for the money. But as she held her sick baby, she said she still needs more. As more people become poor, billions of dollars of Afghanistan's foreign monies are blocked to the still unrecognized Taliban government. The government is still unable to pay public workers,
including people in health and education. Donors and non-governmental organizations have picked up the costs. Russell said money from the European Union is paying teachers. She said that the system is by no means a long-term solution. It's not something that humanitarian organizations can solve on their own, Russell said. I'm Gregory Stockel.
A big debate in American schools is over how much control parents should have in their child's education. Parents around the nation have been protesting how certain topics, such as race, history, and religion, are taught in schools. Some have gone to school board meetings and demand their politicians take steps to control what is taught in the classroom. A school board is a group of elected officials who control educational policy and finances. At least 12 Republican-led states have recently introduced bills that require school districts to post their teaching materials online. Some of the bills permit parents to bring legal action against schools that do not follow the rules. These are called transparency bills. And in the United States Congress, Republicans have introduced a Parents' Bill of Rights. Included in the proposal is a list of rights parents should have when it comes to their child's schooling. For example, parents should have the right to know what their children are being taught, and have the right to see the school budget and spending. Republicans that support the proposal said in a statement that Democrats want to take power away from parents and hand over more control to politicians and teachers' unions to dictate what our children should be taught in classrooms. The Bill of Rights has gained popularity among conservatives in response to things like critical race theory and mask and vaccine mandates in schools. Critical race theory is based on the idea that systemic racism has deeply shaped American society, laws, and policies. The bill was first introduced in November and is unlikely to pass the Democratic-controlled Congress, but it may have caused some Republican states to introduce similar measures. Georgia's state Senate last week approved a measure that protects parental rights in public education. The measure says parents have the right to examine all classroom materials, the right to see all records relating to their child, the right to remove their child from sex education, and the right to prevent the creation of photos, videos, and voice recordings of their children, except for security purposes. Many of the rights already exist. A December survey by Education Week found that most teachers say parents should have a say in the curriculum or the subjects and materials that are being taught. But just 33% of teachers surveyed said parents were involved in selecting curriculum and materials in their district. The survey also suggested that parents and teachers may have differing opinions on what topics should be taught. For example, just 51% of teachers said they believe parents want them to teach about race, but 80% of teachers said they should teach about race and racism. In Virginia, Republican Glenn Youngkin made parents' rights a big part of his campaign for governor, an election he won. He has said that parents should be in charge of their kids' education. But teachers and educators say transparency bills are unnecessary because information on curriculum and spending is already publicly available. Opponents of the bills say it would make teachers' jobs even more difficult. In a Washington Post column, authors Jack Schneider and Jennifer Berkshire argued that parents have no legal right to determine their child's curriculum. United States law supports the idea that education should prepare young people to think for themselves, even if that runs counter to the wishes of parents, they said. Robert Estes is a middle school science and critical thinking teacher in Ohio, one of the states that introduced a transparency bill. He said the bill is a way to control what is taught in the classroom. He told the Associated Press, "The bill is a way to get into the classroom, to pick through what they see and point us in different directions or stop us from doing things." I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. By the middle of the 1930s, America seemed to be moving out of the worst depression in its history. Most people supported the New Deal policies of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The dark view that many Americans held during the final days of President Herbert Hoover's administration seemed to be changing. People began to believe that the United States was facing its problems with energy and hope. Harry Monroe and Jack Weitzel tell more about the New Deal programs of President Roosevelt.
The change could be seen in the way that Americans were moving away from extreme political movements of both the right and the left. Many decided that the best solution was to work through the existing political system. Most importantly, Roosevelt's continued experiments with different programs showed Americans that they did not have to blindly follow political or economic traditions. For years, most Americans had accepted the basic ideas of traditional free market capitalism. But as the Depression began, a small number of Americans became interested in the economic ideas of Karl Marx. Roosevelt believed it was best to travel a path between these two opposite ideas. He basically supported the free market system, but he believed government also had a right and responsibility to act when needed, and he supported new government controls in such important areas as banking, transportation, agriculture, and oil production.
Some Americans did not think it was wise or even possible to mix traditional free market capitalism with government intervention or socialism. Former Republican Treasury Secretary Ogden Mills put it this way: "We can have a free country or a socialist one. We cannot have both. Our economic system cannot be half free and half socialistic. There is no middle ground between governing and being governed, between absolute rule and freedom." Many leftists and socialists agreed with conservatives that it was impossible to mix capitalism and socialism. One leftist publication wrote, "Either the nation must live with the sadness of capitalism, or it must prepare to replace capitalism with socialism. There is no longer a practical middle path. However, Roosevelt and his New Dealers happily rejected these arguments. They aimed the country between rightist and leftist extremes and created a whole new set of rules for government, the economy, and democracy.
Most Americans supported Roosevelt and the Democrats as they experimented with new solutions to the problems of the Depression. They elected Democrats to a large majority in Congress in 1934. 2 years later, they re-elected Franklin Roosevelt to a second term in the White House by one of the largest victories in American history. Roosevelt's big victory made him stronger than ever, so he decided to fight the part of the government that had been blocking many of his programs, the Supreme Court.
Most of the 9 judges on the Supreme Court in 1936 were conservative. They had ruled that many of Roosevelt's most important New Deal programs were illegal. Now, the judges were preparing to decide the future of programs to help old people, labor unions, and others. And there was nothing the president could do under the American system of government. So, Roosevelt called for changes in the system. He asked Congress to reorganize the federal judicial system, and he asked for the power to add several new members to the Supreme Court. In this way, Roosevelt hoped to gain a new majority on the court that would support his views.
Most Americans liked Roosevelt, but people of all opinions feared that the president was trying to destroy the careful system of checks and balances in the federal government. They agreed with him in opposing the court's decisions, but they accepted the right of Supreme Court judges to rule as they thought correct. For this reason, the nation rejected Roosevelt's plan to add new members to the court.
Roosevelt's unsuccessful effort to change the Supreme Court came at the same time as the economy began to get worse. Many Americans thought they had defeated the Depression in 1935, and 36. There was steady economic improvement. Some bankers had even begun to fear that the economy was growing too fast. These bankers called on the nation's central bank, the Federal Reserve Board, to control the expanding money supply. And the Federal Reserve acted to limit the amount of money in use. At the same time, the federal government began reducing the amount of money that it was spending, and it launched the new Social Security tax on workers' incomes. The effect of all these government actions was to limit the amount of money being spent by the government, companies, and private citizens. As a result, the economy began to fall once again into depression.
In August 1937, stock market prices began to fall sharply. In 7 months, the price of stock for the General Motors Corporation fell from $60 to $25. The United States Steel Company stock fell all the way from $121 to $38. In fact, the stock markets lost in 9 months about two-thirds of all the gains that they had made so slowly and painfully since Roosevelt took office. Americans had supported Roosevelt's New Deal program because it offered a solution to the Depression. Now that program seemed to be failing.
Historian Frederick Lewis Allen remembered those dark days of 1937. Goods sold slowly, Allen wrote. Businessmen became frightened and reduced production. 2 million men were thrown out of work in the space of a few months. They became less able to buy what was for sale. The terrible circle of the falling value of the dollar moved all the more rapidly.
The new economic crisis hurt Roosevelt's popularity, and it came at a time when he faced growing opposition within his own Democratic Party. For several years, conservative Democrats from the southeastern part of the country had supported Roosevelt. They liked his leadership and the power that he brought to all Democrats. But they opposed many of his more liberal or experimental social policies.
As the economy and Roosevelt's popularity fell, many of these Southern Democrats began to openly oppose his leadership. They voted with Republicans on important bills before Congress. Roosevelt became very angry about the new opposition from within his own party. He began to intervene personally in Democratic Party primary elections in 1938. He told party members in several states that they should only vote for candidates who would support his New Deal policies. Roosevelt's opponents accused him of interfering in local politics, and Democratic voters agreed with these criticisms. In almost all cases, they rejected the candidates supported by the president. A few months later, voters in the general election gave the Republicans major gains in both the House of Representatives and Senate.
In most situations, such a change in support would have signaled the end of a president's power. If people will not follow, a president cannot lead or be elected. But such was not the case for Roosevelt and the United States in the late 1930s. It was true that economic and political troubles were not solved, but another crisis was growing larger every day, making these other problems seem less and less important. The crisis was in foreign policy. Adolf Hitler and his Nazi party in Germany seemed ready to make war on Europe. And Japanese forces appeared to be planning new aggression in the Pacific. Americans could no longer just worry about their problems at home. A dark cloud was forming outside their door.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.